Good afternoon. My name is Sakpal Ten. I'm the National Program Director for the National Pancreas Foundation. Thank you for joining today's webinar on iNaF and pancreatic cancer, where we'll explore the role of AI in pancreas cancer landscape and then take a closer look at iNaF, the innovative AI tool, and the story behind its development. But first, I wanted to talk to you more about the National Pancreas Foundation and what we do. We fulfill our mission by awarding research grants. We have about 189 NPF Centers of Excellence for pancreatitis and pancreas cancer. And we have about 30 programs for providers and patients. We have chapters all over the nation. Chapters are a great way for patients and families to connect with each other. And the local NPF centers, our annual fundraiser is Pancreas Bowl, and it's happening right now. If you want to be part of the chapter, please contact my colleague Cheyenne. And then our 20th annual Fellow Symposium is our signature event for providers. It's a free CME event for fellows where they can find mentors, collaborate with other attendees on research, and listen to world-renowned speakers talk on various pancreas disease topics. The deadline for the application is November 23rd. So, we hope to see you there. And then we also have a medical providers portal where you'll find CME opportunities and non-CME webinars as well. So this webinar will be on the portal. You'll have NPF program updates, grant opportunities, and pancreas conferences from our centers of excellence. And then make sure to follow us on social media. We post daily. And then because this is it's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, we have pancreas cancer webinars. Our next one is November 24th. It is for patients and it's taking charge of pancreas health. We'll talk about the risk screening and then also nutrition management. And then our next one in December is Navigating Exocrine and Endocrine Challenges for Post-Acute Pancreatitis, where Dr. Bella and Dr. Yadav will talk about that. And then I wanted to introduce our guest speakers. Dr. Kristen Spencer is an associate professor in the Division of Medical Oncology at NYU Langone Health Perlmutter Cancer Center, where she directs a phase one developmental therapeutics program. She specializes in the treatment of hepatobiliary and pancreatic cancers and focuses on early phase clinical trials. Dr. Spencer received the advanced research training through the Cancer Therapy Evaluation Program, Advanced Drug Development Fellowship, and the ASCO AACR Workshop on Methods in Clinical Cancer Research. In addition to her clinical work, she leads and collaborates on early phase research studies. Nationally, she serves as the chair of the ECOG and Akron Genomics Subcommittee and the Hepatopancreatobiliary Working Group. Is a member of the ECOG Akron Task Force on Advancement for Women, the NCI Gastrointestinal Steering Committee's Hepatobiliary Task Force, and the Global Cholangiocarcinoma Alliance Steering Committee. Dr. Daniel King is a gastrointestinal medical oncologist and pancreatic cancer researcher at Northwell Health and Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. After medical school, he earned a doctorate in bioinformatics and genomics from the University of Cambridge, completed residency at Columbia University and a medical oncology fellowship at Stanford. He is director of research and development at Northwell Center for Genomic Medicine, leading a team focused on computational tools to guide patients with suspected pancreas cancer and studying healthcare disparities. He received the Conquer Cancer Career Development Award for using AI to navigate early pancreatic cancer patients to care research and the 2024 Robert A. Wynn Career Development Award for work on his enhancing clinical trial diversity. Thank you both for joining today's webinar, and I'm going to kick it off to Dr. Spencer.
Thank you so very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone that's joining us today. I think we'll just jump right in, and I'd love to just set the stage a little bit regarding pancreatic cancer, specifically pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, which is the main subtype of pancreatic cancer for those of you that need a refresher or aren't as familiar with this. So we see about 64,000 new cases of pancreatic cancer per year in the US. This accounts for about 3% of all cancers, but actually 7% of all cancer deaths. And we've noticed for the last several years that the incidence appears to be rising. We think that may be partly due to aging populations, but also as we improve detecting on imaging and more people are getting imaged for other reasons. That being said, the overall 5-year survival is still only about 12%. We've been boasting, however, that that was an improvement over 10% just a couple years ago. So we're improving, albeit very slowly. And the problem is that pancreatic cancer often presents at a very advanced stage. In fact, only 10 to 15% of patients are eligible for a surgical resection at the time of their diagnosis. And this is for a number of reasons. We don't have any specific early biomarkers for pancreatic cancer that we can measure. These symptoms, often things like jaundice, pain, weight loss, usually unfortunately indicate disease that is already advanced. We also have no population-wide screening test that has proven to be effective or cost-efficient here in 2025. Commonly, we follow a marker in the blood called CA19-9 in patients already diagnosed. However, this marker really lacks sensitivity and specificity for patients with early stage disease or even in precancerous lesions. And further, the imaging we have available to us, including CAT scans, MRIs, and endoscopic ultrasounds, are really not practically executable at a large scale for general screening. There are ongoing trials that are using things like multi-analyte blood tests, liquid biopsy, in order to try and enable earlier detection. That's still an ongoing work in progress. However, pancreatic cancer management really does require that we integrate staging, performance status, comorbidities, biomarkers, and surgical fitness with each and every patient in order to support evidence-based individualized decisions regarding things like surgery, systemic therapy, and surveillance. So we are in dire need of better decision support tools to aid in how we diagnose patients, how we give them information about their prognosis, select their treatments, and match them to clinical trials. So with that, I think we'll go into a brief introduction to AI or artificial intelligence in healthcare in general. And so I would like to ask Dr. King, how would you define AI in medicine for clinicians and patients who are new to this concept?
Sure. Thank you so much, Dr. Spencer, for having me here today. I'm very excited to speak with the group here in the NPF. In terms of how do we define AI, the shorthand that I use when speaking with patients and some junior providers is to think of AI as a computational tool that can recognize patterns. When the computers can recognize those patterns, they can often do things that are helpful with that information. So the clinical decision support tools that Dr. Spencer mentioned is an increasing use of these tests. It's essentially providing an independent interpretation of some kind of test result. And if I could give some examples maybe to highlight what that is. So many of us providers may be familiar with how for a long time now, computers have given their own interpretation of what an EKG pattern looks like and what it might mean. I think many of us, that usage has sort of crept into common use without us thinking too much about how AI tools are being used, but it certainly is an example of how AI has been adopted for most of our healthcare systems. There are many applications that go beyond the single EKG test. I've heard recently about the patterns of an echocardiogram being viewed by an AI tool. I've heard of tools that are listening to what a stethoscope listens and tries to give an interpretation of what kind of pathology may be happening in lungs or hearts. We recently have seen some new AI tools that can look not only at radiology, but at pathology, trying to devise some interpretation of what's being seen in terms of the tissue and its impact on prognosis, and even a prediction of what type of genetics, what type of biomarkers may be present in tissue. So it's been really incredible in a short period of time witnessing how more and more of these AI tools are both being used for early clinical applications, but especially developing clinical applications that I think perhaps foreshadows how in not too many years to come, we're going to see more and more examples of AI helping doctors with their tests.
Totally agree with you. And we're certainly seeing more and more of these conversations, particularly at national meetings where we talk about this as a community and perhaps fret about it a little bit and our jobs being replaced in the future. But before we adopt AI and think that, you know, we're going to be living in the land of the machine completely, could you go over, at least from your perspective, what some of the biggest challenges are for integrating AI into everyday clinical practice, but also what the opportunities might be that you see?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think one of the issues with an emerging technology is we have to do so with perhaps some excitement, but also prudency to make sure that the way that these tools are being developed is being done in a way that is equitable, that the interpretation of the tests are valid and accurate. There's certainly an issue with tool availability. There are sort of this emergence of many of these tools, which are not yet widely available for clinical use. I think that's one of the challenges is many of us read about new technologies that are emerging, but don't yet have access to them. We hope that as these technologies continue to be developed and validated, that they are increasingly broader available, not only for maybe the largest healthcare systems, but also for community networks as well. As these tools are being rolled out, we need to test whether they are accurate in their interpretation. That accuracy is subject in part to some bias. The way that tools are being validated needs to ensure that the results are generalizable to broader groups of populations. And I think it really behooves the researchers to make sure that we're thinking about whether the results are interpretable. Data security is an issue, right? So these tools are often mining many thousands of records that are being generated in electronic healthcare systems. And so making sure that that there is adequate governance over how these tools and regulatory support and how these tools are being deployed is crucial. And whether there's a need for any medical liability to ensure that there's protection of the data that the tools are using. And also there's computational power, right? So all of these tools are reading through often many thousands of records. So the need to increase the data analytics capabilities of healthcare systems, and whether some of these tools are being outsourced to third-party vendors introduces, you know, additional safeguards that need to be considered. So there are certainly many aspects to how these tools need to be developed and rolled out that make somewhat complex how to do it. On the other hand, as I think we are now starting to see, the value proposition for some of these tools is so strong that I think that these issues will be overcome with some good thought. And I hope to be in very small way, a small part of that solution for pancreas cancer.
Yeah, I'd actually like to shift gears a little bit to iNav. You know, I'm so impressed with your work here. I'm at a loss when my cell phone won't turn on and you're doing these wonderful things in AI. So, you know, what was the catalyst for creating iNav and what unmet need did it address in pancreas cancer care?
Sure. Thanks so much. So what happened in our healthcare system when I joined some 3 or 4 years ago is we recognized that there were some opportunities to improve care delivery for patients with pancreas cancer. Specifically, actually, the trigger was a biospecimen-based study we had for African-American patients with pancreas cancer, in which we wanted to understand the molecular basis of the disease and whether there was some molecular underpinnings explaining adverse outcomes in that population. That was actually the specific trigger. And what was challenging that we observed is how hard it was to enroll the population of patients we needed before they underwent their diagnostic biopsy. For this particular study, we needed to consent patients prior to their diagnostic biopsy. And as an oncologist, I'm generally not interacting with patients until they have a diagnosis, until they have a biopsy and a diagnosis of pancreas cancer. So what we were talking about is how do we find a patient much earlier in their clinical trajectory? What we did is we first started looking in our EHR of patients that underwent a biopsy and then looked at some preceding factors in the EHR to try to understand how to grab a handle on how to find a patient before they underwent a biopsy. And pretty quickly, we realized that before a biopsy, all these patients had a scan. They had a scan that showed a mass, and the mass on the imaging test is what triggered the referral for a biopsy. It makes sense. So we thought, all right, well, if the scans are happening before the biopsy, then maybe there's a way for us to use the scan and trigger a notification to our study team that there's someone with a new scan that shows a new mass in the pancreas. And that's what gave birth ultimately to our tool, which we call iNav, for navigating patients who are in need of subsequent follow-up for a suspicious mass in biopsy. So as we started exploring this tool, we realized that the benefit of this, let's call it referral strategy from the point of identification to a navigator whose job it is to help connect patients, pull them into care. We thought that beyond this biospecimen study, we may be able to more broadly apply this technology to take anyone with a new suspected pancreas cancer and not only enroll them into a biospecimen study, but also potentially to expedite their path from the point of radiology to their appointment with a GI doctor for biopsy, and ultimately their appointment to an oncologist for review, and perhaps even increase the number of patients that are getting onto clinical trials by referencing our clinical trial pre-screening program too. So we realize that there's actually a whole host of specialists that are trying to find patients with these suspected pancreas masses. We just didn't really have a way to bridge that gap until this technology was developed. And since it's been developed, we've spent a lot of time trying to understand what its strengths, its limitations are. And we did so. We built the tool really with a broader team. It's been a really fantastic adventure over the last 2 years that we've developed this tool.
And can you tell us who's part of that team? So what expertise does each person bring to the project? And you had mentioned on a Northwell podcast about hiring more people for your staff. Do you foresee the program growing any further, or what are the future directions there?
Sure. So as we started developing this technology, I quickly realized that I can't do this alone, right? I'm a medical oncologist, and it's within my job description to take care of patients with pancreas cancer. What I really needed was a team of folks from different disciplines, that also interact with patients, but who interact with patients before they have a confirmed diagnosis of pancreas cancer. So our team grew to include a nurse practitioner and navigator, Tiffany Zavadsky, a GI doctor as well, Sandeep Nadella, a project manager. We had Diksha Kaura on this. And what we did with that small team was develop the AI engine, deploy the AI engine with our computational team. That was Anthony Carvino and additional help from the IT team. And then using the technology, we implemented a small pilot project, which we completed. And as you were mentioning, Dr. Spencer, on the podcast, through that pilot project, we were able to get additional funding through the ASCO Foundation. And through there, we hired a small team and are now, we've rolled out this initiative over a 2 year study where we're recruiting 200 patients. And so we meet each day to review the patients that are flagged by the radiology team and ultimately are studying whether there may truly be an impact in the care delivery for the patients in our healthcare system.
Wow, it's incredible. How long did it take to develop this from concept to sort of deploying it out there?
Yeah, so it's hard to believe this now, but in 2023, no one, or at least no one in my circle, had heard of anything called ChatGPT or large language model or so at that time, the state-of-the-art AI model was something called a natural language processing machine, which is basically another way of using computers to interpret language. But again, sort of unlike the LLMs that we've grown familiar to, an NLP tool is trained. So what we did, and this took about 6 months, is we worked together, reviewed about 1,000 CAT scans that either did or did not have a mass in the pancreas, so some kind of suspicious finding in the pancreas that was largely masses or double duct signs in the pancreas. And then we annotated for each scan whether there was suspicion or was no suspicion of cancer. And then we used that information to train an NLP model, and then we deployed that NLP model. This was back in 2023. So that process, the training process, which now is deprecated by these newer models, but that training process took us a few months for us to test it, first of all, and then ultimately to deploy it. Yeah. So that was about a 6 month period to do such a thing, to develop the engine. Maybe about another 6 months or so to conduct our pilot study that compared how things were going in our navigation team before and after implementation of the tool. And then ultimately we wrote up the results for our grant, and we wrote up those results for publication, and the results for publication are in review, and the grant is underway, rolled out.
I'd love to come back to that, but first, could you, you've alluded to some of this, but could you summarize for us what the key features of iNav are, and how are they supporting clinicians in their decision making?
Sure. Yeah. So essentially, the tool provides a way for our specialists, our dedicated pancreas cancer, let's call it intake team, to find patients with newly suspected cancer. So although the NLP tool required a lot of training and deployment, it is what helped us get this off the ground. But this is not only about the identification of a radiology report with a suspected mass. That is only our part, which we call our lesion review. We review the lesion that's flagged on the radiology report to make sure that this truly looks like a pancreas cancer. And then, beyond that, we then also do a chart review. So the iNav process really is several components. It's the AI-assisted identification, followed by a chart review with the team to determine what the navigation needs are for that patient, followed by ultimately a referral to a navigator with that information sort of on a silver platter, right? So we know we found this patient for you, who here's a summary of their case. Here's what's been done so far for them. Can you please help us take this patient, communicate with them, make sure that the information has been disclosed, and help get this patient set up with a biopsy, with our clinical trial team, with an oncologist, with our pancreas cancer tumor board. So we have, it really is linking the identification of a patient with a suspected mass with our referral and navigation engine. That's what makes iNav special. And that's what we're studying now.
Wonderful. Do you offhand have a sort of real world example, perhaps with a patient of yours or one of your team members, on how iNav has helped the clinician in their decision making, for instance, with choosing an optimal therapy for the patient?
Yeah, sure. So every once in a while, everything works as it's supposed to, and we give each other a big high five. One specific example. So we have a clinical trial here for first line metastatic pancreas cancer that we developed within our network, and we're searching all the time to get patients onto that trial. About 3 months ago now, we had a patient where it appeared that there was a mass in the pancreas. When we reviewed the scan, it also looked like there were masses in the liver, consistent with a radiographic suspicion of metastatic pancreas cancer. So when we found that, we alerted not only our navigator to reach out to the patient and to undergo a biopsy, but we were able to interact with the whole clinical team that was taking care of this patient to do everything we could to get this patient on the trial. And The way that we did that was several fold. First of all, we sent a communication to the team noting that there were some liver masses and requesting an IR, a biopsy of one of those liver masses, which did get done. And that got done within 3 days of finding the patient. And then we knew that this patient could be a potential candidate for our trial. So we immediately sent the information off to our pre-screening team. We also scheduled the appointment with me in clinic for 1 week after the identification of the radiology suspicion. And we expedited the review of the pathology that was done only a few days after the identification. So this patient was found by our tool. And 1 week later, we had the results of the biopsy. The patient was in to see me in clinic, and we consented them that day for a clinical trial. I should also just mention that the patient was Mandarin speaking, and we have a separate program here with the Lustgarten to help, where we hired a Mandarin speaking navigator to help facilitate appointments and clinical trial enrollment for Mandarin speaking patients. And so we actually had all the communications being done with this patient through our Mandarin speaking navigator, who also joined us in person on the day of our review. So it was just like a beautiful confluence of all the different care delivery programs that we're trying to do for pancreas cancer. It was an exemplar, I must admit. This does not always happen, but it was really neat to kind of see how everything comes together when we're all working hard, you know, all of the teams that are all dedicating their jobs to try to improve care delivery, watching it all come to fruition and for one patient was a real plus and a morale booster that day.
Yeah, I'll say wonderful, wonderful work. I think that's a wonderful example of a success story. Could you tell us a little bit more about the pilot studies you were alluding to that have now led to the grant submission, which we certainly wish you the best of luck on, by the way?
Thanks so much. Yeah, happy to do that. So our pilot project was conducted back in 2023. And what we did is we had two different months, January and June, that were included in the analysis. The months were different. In January, we called that a retrospective cohort that consisted of 38 patients. Those 38 patients were found in January because we deployed our tool and we looked through all of the radiology reports in January that had a sign of a suspicious mass. Okay, so that's how we found that group in January. But at that time, we did nothing beyond the identification. There was no link directly to a navigator. We just simply found those patients, and then retrospectively, we observed what happened to them over time, over about a 6 month period. What fraction of those patients were biopsied? What fraction of those patients were seen by an oncologist in our network and received treatment? So we gathered those data, but we had, at that time, there was no link to the navigation team to influence the natural history of those patients. Subsequently, in June, not only did we deploy the AI model to find patients, but also within 24 hours, we linked that identification to our referral group, So that after finding the patient, we then contacted our navigator. Actually, the navigator was part of our daily team. And we asked the navigator, what can you do about getting this patient connected to care as soon as possible? So it was our attempt to see what impact there might be on care delivery by immediately referring the patient to a navigator. And in that month, in June, we had 33 patients. So what we ended up doing is comparing this group of about 38 patients from January to 33 patients, where we not only identified patients, but we also tried to pull them into care. So this is not a very large cohort, but it was enough to show some promising improvements. So for example, the number of days between radiology report to biopsy went from 12 days in January to 6 days in the prospective cohort. So by implementing the navigator to pull these patients into care, we were able to essentially like halve the number of days to get to a biopsy. We also saw that the number of days to get to an oncologist appointment decreased from 27 days to 17 days. So that also was about, you know, a halving in the number of days to get to an oncology appointment, and the number of treatment days, the number of days between radiology identification to treatment shrank from 56 days to 35 days. So in all of the metrics that we measured, the time to biopsy, the time to oncology appointment, to treatment, we saw some encouraging improvement, let's say a reduction in the delays, if you like, for the number of days it took to realize those clinical outcome metrics. We also studied whether those metrics showed improvements across different populations. So I didn't mention this earlier, I should have mentioned this, that when we trained the AI model, we ensured that the reports that went into the training included all populations, not only white male populations, but all genders and many different races and ethnicities. So when we looked at the results for our prospective versus our retrospective cohorts in 2023, we also thankfully were able to demonstrate that those improvements in care delivery were shared across different racial groups as well. It's small numbers, but at least we were able to see that the numbers were decreased. There are also one other thing. There were no patients in the prospective cohort whose treatment was beyond 60 days. Whereas in the retrospective cohort, there were actually 3 patients who had like an exceedingly long time between when their report was done and when treatment was. So if anything, it seems like this technology is kind of helping prevent no one from getting left behind. So in addition to just having sort of an average improvement, we're also there for the people that, for whatever reason, it's that much more difficult to get connected with treatment. So we hope that those were encouraging, or we found at least that those pilot data were encouraging enough for us to go in for a grant, and we hope that they are encouraging enough for us to publish, and we look forward to seeing what happens as we continue to roll out this next generation of the tool that we're studying now.
Wonderful. Congratulations also on being one of Time's best inventions of 2024. So I wanted to piggyback on what you've been telling us and just ask if you're able to walk us through the steps on how your team, and with your guidance, how you all ended up with that wonderful achievement, if it's different from what you've shared so far.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really an honor. We were delighted that the research was picked up by Time Magazine. I think in part it's a testament to how Time recognizes the ability or the importance of providing equitable healthcare to many different populations. Certainly, the recognition drew favorable attention to this unmet need of improving care delivery to this population. And while we recognize we have a long way to go improving the model, we are definitely looking forward to continue working with our healthcare system and other partners, hopefully in the future, to advance the technology further. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, of course. Well, it can't all be roses and sunshine. So I'm going to ask you the hard question about the challenges you've encountered with deploying this.
Sure. I think one challenge in deploying an AI tool is, at least for care delivery, is you realize that the computer work goes only so far, right? So it really makes us appreciate how, we're not, humans are still very much in the loop, and we need to keep humans in the loop for now. So these are decision support tools, but they are certainly being done with teams. So we definitely need to continue to encourage teams to work together to make sure that we are deploying these tools in the right way. I think one thing is the next steps after what happens to a patient with a newly suspected disease, pancreas cancer or other, could be pancreatitis, could be really anything, it takes some clinical acumen to help determine what the next step needs to be. And the workflows for engaging the personnel to make those things happen may vary by healthcare system. So what I would love to do is deploy this tool more widely that is beyond our healthcare systems to other healthcare systems, and maybe even, you know, beyond the United States, right? If there are ways that we can mine data, and computers are very good at mining data, but then use that data to trigger the next step. And that next step requires some information that is specific to a healthcare system. I think the challenge that I see is, how do we educate this process with the institutional knowledge, the institutional specific knowledge, so that all patients, regardless of what institution they're presenting to, can benefit from an AI identification, right? So it's really a matching exercise. And this is, you know, iNav is one example where patients are coming in, they have needs. We have doctors and providers that are looking for patients that have those needs. So this technology is a way to match patients with suspected pancreas cancer with a pancreas specialist network. What can we do to think more broadly about all the various conditions that can be potentially found using AI tools and all of the referral targets that would need to know or should know about that information? And how do we make that link? So I think the real challenge of how to expand this type of AI healthcare, sometimes I'd like to think of it as sort of proactive healthcare, because we're engaging the specialist teams before they even, you know, have heard about these patients, right? We're proactively engaging the specialists to help pull patients into care. So how do we make the link between an AI-assisted identification of a patient and the referral targets who would like to know about it? So that's part of the, I think, how AI technologies need to consider is how to link the identification with the human resource. And that's part of what I also hope to explore as we continue to roll out the technology.
Well, that's a wonderful segue. I'd love to before we get to questions, talk a little bit about future directions. And how do you envision AI and iNav in particular evolving specifically in pancreas cancer care in the short term? And, you know, what potential do you see it to have to improve patient outcomes and perhaps enhance workflow efficiency in other areas of comment for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I like to think of healthcare very much as a service industry. I think many providers forget that, you know, we are here to provide services to patients, and part of service is customer support. So what I like to do is think of how to roll out these tools so that we can improve the customer service that providers are giving to their patients. So instead of having, let's say, patients click on phone trees in order to get connected with the services they need, what can we do to have providers more proactively engage with the patients who are in need of services? So I think it's a streamlined linkage of these services that this technology hopefully will help with as it further develops.
I can't agree with you more, and I think this is where it's going. So, you know, more broadly, how do you see AI progressing in the oncology space, and what else are you excited about that's on the horizon now?
Sure, yeah. So I've definitely seen some tools that are entering the clinic now. Maybe some of the providers who are on the call may have started working with many of these tools that are doing like summaries, right? So you have a patient come into your clinic and you're conducting a note, and now you have to write up your note. And many of those notes are now being written by AI tools. So I've seen increasing usage of those AI tools come into fruition to help the doctors reduce the number of, let's say, minutes in writing an average report. I have seen, you know, the emergence of various clinician support tools. Some of them are based on very simple models. For example, I just saw one where if an elevated PSA level is found by a primary care doctor, it triggers a referral opportunity for that patient and the provider to a urologist for further evaluation, right? So that's pretty easy, right? That's based on an elevated PSA level, right? But I've also seen more complicated things. So, for example, in our healthcare system now, an AI model is reading every radiology report for aneurysms. And I found this out because one day I got a message in my inbox that said that this scan has been reviewed by an AI model looking for aneurysm. Your patient has a 3.4 centimeter aneurysm. Would you like us to place a referral to our vascular surgeon for further review? And I clicked on yes, right? So there are definitely these technologies that are emerging using AI tools. We have one researcher here called Let Sleeping Patients Lie that tries to understand who is hospitalized and does not need to be waken up at 4 o'clock in the morning to have their vitals checked, right? Because you might imagine that there are some patients that are sufficiently stable where there's really no need to check vitals every 4 hours, especially in the middle of the night, right? So more and more we're seeing some of these computational tools make their way, and interact with providers. It's a fascinating time. And I like to think that it is wholly a very positive time. I would just like to say one example of something I'm a little bit wary of, where increasingly some of the AI tools are being used to draft automatic responses to patients who call in with requests for information about some symptoms that they have. And so the tools are automatically providing information about what they have, which doesn't seem very different from the person writing to ChatGPT and asking ChatGPT about the symptoms that they have. So, again, I view the job of a doctor and as providers as being good customer service agents. So I just hope and want to continue advocating for doctors to remain in that role of providing a good service. So anything that AI tools are doing to help with that mission, I think is a positive thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's as you know, one of the things our patients routinely bring up is being woken up in the night. So that's a great example. I've noticed here at NYU, they're doing a pilot of every scan that gets done. There's an addendum layman's summary for the patient to read to interpret their scan. So I think this was meant to sort of address the scanxiety that we all know exists. It remains to be seen. I'm asking my patients about it, whether it's doing that or not. Most of them hadn't even noticed yet that it was there, but we'll see if that happens. But fascinating, fascinating. And to what the point that you brought up about that novel project, for other researchers who are interested in AI research in pancreas cancer, it's really a blooming field and to some degree is new for many of us right now. So what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I would say embrace it. Start experimenting. Seek opportunities where some of these tools are being developed. There's the AI-enabled chart software that I had mentioned is becoming increasingly common. For many of you in your healthcare system, it may be available in sort of like an opt-in approach. So take the splurge, like give it a try. You might find that these tools help reduce the amount of time, improve your efficiency. I guess it's sort of being open to the possibility that these tools are helpful. Also, the large language models, they're public, they're free. Some of our healthcare systems have embedded PHI protected versions of these within our healthcare system. You should never put any sensitive information into a large language model that is just the vanilla run-of-the-mill ChatGPT tool. This should only sensitive information should not go into those tools unless you're sure that it's being run within your department's firewall. Just a disclaimer there. Never use a public LLM to put sensitive information in. But one can imagine there are many different ways of using these LLMs. I got an email literally yesterday from a drug company. I had applied for an off-label usage of their drug for a patient of mine who has a mutation that I think would be a good candidate for a matched agent, but the drug that I want to use is not FDA approved for that disease. And so I applied for off-label usage of that drug, and the drug company sent me what prompts to use into an LLM that I could use to try to get a letter drafted in support of the patient. The company actually sent me the prompts to use. This is the first time I've ever seen this, literally yesterday. I think sponsors are increasingly using LLMs. Many of you may already be using LLMs to draft letters to drug companies or recommendation letters for your trainees. It's a new world out there, and I encourage, the only way that we're going to get better in using these tools is by practicing, understanding their challenges, their limitations, being open to them, but being mindful of the complexities and, again, the limitations of the tool. So start using them, and if you're not already, and you may find that they have some really favorable benefits.
And for clinicians who are interested in learning more about what you're doing, collaborating with INAV, what is the best way to contact you or your team?
Oh yeah, sure. So I'm very happy to share our contact information. My own email address is dking14@northwell.edu. I'm happy to hear from anyone on the call with their own suggestions, happy to collaborate with people on the call. For me, it's all about improving the care that we can deliver to our patients with pancreas cancer. And if anyone out there shares that mission, let's combine forces and work together on it.
Thank you so much. I think we have some time for questions, but maybe we'll start out with some questions that came in through registration. So thinking back to taking it a step back to even earlier than diagnosis of pancreas cancer, we know there are many patients that have these precursor lesions that have a risk for evolving into pancreas cancer. And obviously, many of us feel like the key to solving, for lack of a better term, pancreas cancer is detecting it early and minimizing the number of patients that actually get diagnosed with pancreas cancer. So do you think that INAV is a tool that could be used in some way at some point in patients who develop an IPMN to either improve the screening methods that are used or screening schedule, and then hopefully, detect a cancer early as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think there are precursor lesions and precursor conditions that make it more likely to develop pancreas cancer. I will say that Dr. Sandeep Nadella, who was had helped develop the technology, is a GI doctor and is very much invested in using this tool to evaluate different types of cysts. The next generation version of his tool that he's doing is using what's called entity extraction LLM to characterize cysts in various ways in order to try to triage and prioritize for our healthcare system who are the patients that most need a referral to a GI doctor but don't yet have one. As many on the call may know, cysts are very common, but only a small minority of the cysts are developing into cancer. So trying to understand which of those cysts are the ones that most are in need of referral to a GI doctor is of huge importance. The NPF does a lot of work with pancreatitis. There are other conditions beyond IPMNs that are precursor lesions. And certainly those are things that we also could identify with computational means. I would say that in our technology, which is really based on reading the words in a scan, this technology has a natural extension to computer vision, where we are also looking at radiographic features, so-called radiomic features of various imaging modalities to better predict what types of precursor lesions have the greatest potential for turning into pancreas cancer. That requires large longitudinal studies, but I think certainly could be done. I also just want to make a link to the other comment that I see here, which I think has a nice extension, which is, it's not only about radiomic features or other, let's say, other clinical data that's in the EHR that can also be mined. There's also the idea of whether there are blood tests that we could do to further understand what the risk of developing pancreas cancer, right? So many different companies are developing early detection tests. Many of them are based not on necessarily circulating tumor DNA, some of them are, but also on circulating signals of methylation and even RNA, circulating RNA in the bloodstream. Many of the conditions such as pancreatitis may be precursors to pancreas cancer. Pancreatitis may have its own RNA signature. So as these technologies, these blood-based technologies continue to develop, I think we're going to increasingly see that the future of early cancer detection is not limited to radiology, but is radiology plus many other things. A mining of the EHR data that are available. Okay, one example would be patients with new onset diabetes and weight loss. That's an interesting combination of specific factors for pancreas cancer. So clinical data reports, as well as blood-based assessment. So early indications that the patient is either we're looking at the development of a cancer that could be based on DNA or RNA changes, or the impact on the body of a developing cancer. So for example, many of us have had the flu before and we feel terrible, right? And that's all because of the rewiring in our brain from cytokines that the infection is putting out. The same kind of thing is happening from cancer, right? So cachexia for pancreas cancer precedes the detection of pancreas cancer for many patients. People are losing weight. They're not feeling well. They're feeling crummy. Even their emotional state is changing. And much of that is probably detectable in the blood. So the future of early cancer detection is probably way beyond imaging, but also likely involving a series of different biomarkers found in the blood that increasingly are going to be checked, I would guess, in regular intervals by primary care doctors. So, you know, all of that is going to be AI driven. So AI is, you know, I hope in the future for how we prevent a variety of cancers beyond pancreas cancer that leverages many, many pieces of information and increasingly blood-based tests.
You were alluding to this a little bit, Dan, so maybe you've already addressed it, but this question is specifically about how iNav may change the way chronic pancreatitis is followed and whether we can envision a day where we see surgery being delayed for patients that have genetic conditions that predispose them to chronic pancreatitis.
Yeah, that's it's a great question. I mean, it's one of the real tragedies of this disease for young kids is many of them end up needing to have their pancreas removed. And that is a major, you know, lifestyle change, right? So what can we do to try to better understand, again, sort of predict whether a patient who has chronic pancreatitis is more or less likely to develop pancreas cancer? That's a tough one, but I think the lessons are similar. The lessons are similar that we're going to need to extract from early detection. What signals may exist in the blood and in the imaging that may help us distinguish? And, you know, to your point, this is doable, I think, but is going to require patients who are followed over long periods of time with that information, like blood tests and imaging, available over long periods of time, so that we can create essentially like a training set and a validation set over that database to help us understand how well can we predict those factors. So, you know, I hope it's a good question to ask, and I hope that over time we will accrue the data sets necessary to answer that question.
So I think I'll just summarize for all of us that, and Dan, you can please feel free to add or take away anything that I say, but I think what we've learned today is that AI is first here to stay, and we can expect to see it being used more and more, particularly in the clinical settings. That being said, it's a supportive tool and it's not a replacement for clinicians. I don't think it will ever be a replacement for clinicians, for whatever it's worth, for my personal opinion on the matter. But iNav in particular can improve guidance. It can help us make decisions better for our patients with pancreatic cancer. And we'd like to see this expand. We wish you best of luck on your grant. We'd love to collaborate more with you. And we're so happy that you're willing and able to do that. And I think lastly, I would really like to thank the National Pancreas Foundation and Arcus Biosciences for supporting this seminar today. Thank you, Dan, for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity again, Dr. Spencer, and really appreciate the excellent summary. Thank you also to the National Pancreas Foundation for your interest in this project.